Thank you, Tom. So preparing for this was hard for me because I could probably talk for hours about all the research I did about the region and specific things that happened there. I didn't think you would all want to sit in on a research project. And since we recently had a guest talk about the UU Partner Church Council and his experiences with a Romanian church partnership, I didn't want to repeat that. And so instead, I'm just going to try to tell it from my perspective, the things that I experienced using pictures from the trip. But I do need to give some context. So as I mentioned in the children's story, the Unitarians that we visited are Khasi. Much about them is unique. Their language is Austroasiatic, and it is more related to Khmer than other languages in the region. So the words that they use for mother and father and things like that are more like they have in Thailand and other places. Their native religion is monotheistic, and they follow a matrilineal pattern where the youngest daughter, not the oldest son, the youngest daughter inherits the family home and lands and works in conjunction with things. The women are very strong in the culture overall. I would say a lot of gender equity there, but that is not to say that men don't play important roles, particularly in civic business and governmental life. You know, everything is open to men, but as far as family inheritance goes, that's an important part of their culture that's quite different than other places in the world. The specific village that I visited, and I'll have a map in a moment, but it's in a mountainous area where most of the families grow potatoes and cabbage. There's no commodity pricing, and so if you sell everything, you know, right at harvest, that it's difficult to get beyond a subsistence kind of living. They do eat a lot of rice, but they can't grow it there. Down the mountain they can, but they have to buy their rice to eat, so that's a continual expense. The village itself, which there's actually kind of two there that we interacted with, but there's no commercial establishment of any kind. There's a church in people's houses and a church in people's houses and a school and the children's village I'm going to talk about. The closest bank would be about 45 minutes by car, and almost no one owns a vehicle. There is a sort of a taxi service that I'll talk about. The younger generation is basically trilingual. They speak their native Khasi at home, but they learn English and Hindi in school as compulsory subjects. The closest school serves many, many village children, and some of them walk up to 30 minutes or more one way each day, and a lot of school happens in the rainy season, so they're walking in the rain, not the snow maybe, but the rain each day, 30 minutes to school. And the school just recently graduated its first year 12 students. This first class that came through was small, but prior to that, education in the village would have stopped at year 9, and if a family wanted their child to go on, they would have needed to basically send them somewhere to be boarded or stay with extended family members to continue past the 9th grade. And quite frankly, there's a lot of concern there about rural flight. As they get better educated kids who are continuing on in school, there's always the possibility that they move on to bigger cities, and what role will they have in village life moving forward is kind of a big question for people there. And then, so that was kind of culture and village life, agriculture. But then on religion, I am just completely ripping off one of my travel mates, Daniel Cantor from the First Unitarian Fellowship in Church, I think. First Unitarian Church of Dallas was one of the people that was in my travel group. And so I listened to his sermon that he gave after our trip, and this is how he summarized our belief partnership there. So this area of India had a lot of Welsh, but also other missionaries there about 160, 175 years ago. And in general, they were very successful. The monotheism of the Khasi people probably fed into that, but it's estimated that about 85% of Khasis practice some form of Christianity today, including Catholicism, Anglicanism, and Presbyterianism are the most common in the area. Well, there was one gentleman named Hajam Kasor Singh about 130 years ago, and he was reading his Presbyterian Bible, and he did what many of us have probably done sitting in this fellowship, and he said, some of this stuff just doesn't make any sense. And so he believed, the Khasi word for the divine is ublé. So he believed that ublé is the divine and the divine is one, and that Jesus was a man and a teacher, and that we are essentially good but capable of bad acts, and that the concept of salvation should be about who we become in this life and not about acceptance into heaven. So, more or less, Hajam Kasor Singh had created Unitarianism, which someone told him a few years later, literally. So he began to correspond with Unitarians in Britain and America. And he started with five people in his church, and now there are over 10,000. So 130 years of this very organic religious tradition is what I got a glimpse of in my short visit there. It said Hajam Kasor Singh corresponded with William Ellery Channing in the last 10 years of Channing's life. Khasi Unitarians don't celebrate Christmas or Easter. Some congregations do not use the Bible. And their hymn book is their central text, which for us Western visitors, they use a Roman script, and the language is basically written phonetically. So most of their church services are the singing of hymns, and they're pretty catchy, and they have a lot of repetition in it, so you can kind of follow along, even if you don't know what all the words mean. Through a lot of local work in the Khasi Hills, and then through United States UU partnerships, an orphanage was founded 10 years ago. This is a place for children who have lost their mothers and either do not have extended family willing to take them, or, much more common, have extended family who simply have too many mouths to feed. My understanding is that these children are given, not really taken, in the way we think about kids entering the system here. These children are given to live in a place where they will be fed, get medical attention, and get a good education. They stay within their tribal culture, within their belief system. They continue to use their language, and they stay in touch with their extended family and home villages. So they're open. People, relatives can stop by, or if there's a big celebration in their home village, then they can be gotten there, then they get taken there. And everyone there works very hard to make the best of what would be a difficult situation for these kids. So about 8 years ago, I was looking for an international charity where I felt like I could be really connected with people on a more individual level. And I saw that the UU Partner Church Council was seeking sponsorships for individual students in a couple different places around the world, and in particular in India with this orphanage. So I began sponsoring a student about 8 years ago. Several people have asked me about sponsoring a student since they heard about this. This is no longer their model. The First Unitarian of Dallas is now the sponsor for the whole children's village. But in any case, you probably want to see some pictures. So the UUPCC planned our pilgrimage for the 10th anniversary celebration of the Children's Village, and we had a series of calls before we left to get to know each other and ask questions and sort of understand what our larger purpose for this visit might be. Two maps of India. I don't know why I made them different sizes, but we flew into Delhi, which is the central orange dot, and then took a connecting flight. Well, I shouldn't say even we. Individually, we were to meet on the orange dot right above the red state, which is Guwahati. So there's not even an airport of any size in the entire state of Meghalaya, which is where we went. That red state is Meghalaya. The whole region is called Northeast India. We flew into the neighboring state and then had to drive to the capital city of Meghalaya before we went up into the villages. So what's nestled in between that area, that little arm of India that comes out to the side, is Bangladesh. And so when the rains come in, they come in and then they hit the mountains of Meghalaya, that red state area, and, you know, big rainy season, as I said, and there's a place there that's considered the rainiest place on earth by rainfall averages every year. So I just don't think, not experience, and I don't think I can quite imagine what the rainy season is like there. And so, let me see. Oh, for a little bit of scale, if you drove from Delhi to Guwahati Airport, that would be about the same as driving across the United States, distance-wise. And then before I begin, because I didn't get a good picture of Bari or Bari Shisha, so this was our on-the-ground hostess. I stole this from her Facebook page. She was our hostess, coordinator, translator, and she is a force of nature. She was pivotal in getting the land rights to build the children's village, which is a boys' home and a girls' home, which is very complicated because there's a lot of community land and other things like that. And she's also very committed to trying to get government support to the area, both for the children's villages and the school and things like road repair and things like that. So she was our hostess and a wonderful one at that. And this is the U.S. group. So if I start at the left, Christy from Dallas, and then Katie Scudera is in the jeans in front of me. And she actually lived in this village for about a year while the Children's Village was being built. And she's a UU minister in Needham, Massachusetts. And so this was a bit of a return for her and was very emotional trip for her. And then there I am, and Karen is in front of me, and she represented a congregation out of Washington State, but lives actually in a sailboat on the East Coast right now. But because of her commitment to this partnership that they have with people in Kurong, she's been 3 or 4 times and stays active in her congregation. And then the tall guy in the back is Daniel Cantor. And the girl in the green sweater is Sophie, and next to her is her mom, Valerie, and they represented the Fellowship of Metro Atlanta North, Human is what they call it, and they partner with the local church that we went to. Behind them is Richard, also from Dallas, and then Gio, also from Dallas, who is Daniel's son, so this was a father-son trip for them. And then Maureen is in the back in the red shirt, and she represented the Pittsburgh congregation, and they sponsor the school that we visited. So I won't belabor you with more about them. But we had a group of 10 people with Katie and Karen being repeaters, and that gave us a lot of confidence in what we were doing. Okay. So this is not a good picture. We have many not good pictures in here. But so that one night we spent in the capital city of Shillong, three elders from the Unitarian organization there, which is called the Unitarian Union of Northeast India, UUNEI, they came and met with us and allowed us to just ask them any question. Their faith is different than ours, and the way they approach it is different, and they would not call themselves universalists. Beside Daniel there is Tehok, and in the very back with the hat on is Mankara, and then up front is Klur. And Tehok and Mankara are great-grandsons of Hajim Kisor Singh. And so it was really wonderful to meet with them and have them be so open to all of our questions, large and small. And they brought this portrait of Hajim Kisor Singh with them to show us, and he's the seated gentleman there. Yes? Oh, okay. He's saying I can point if I want, but is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. So we drive and drive and drive, curvy roads, and the buildings and the houses never end. It's not like there's a big gap and then you hit the next town. It's like all the homes that exist. I'm sure this is not true, but it's like it's just house. Even as we get farther and farther, I expected it to end at some point and then there to be a break and then there to be something else, but that's not how it was. It was house, church, school. Lower down in the drive, there might have been a shop or things like that, but it's just lined up house after house. And so we don't even know where we are. And there's no signs, you know. You don't know you're entering this village or leaving that village or anything else. But it seemed to me that the basic configuration of villages is if you went to this church, then if you went to the Kurong church, then you're affiliated with Kurong village. And if you went to the Mao Sendri church, you're affiliated there. So this is the first stop we made to let Karen off to be with her partner people. And so we all took turns because we love the chalice, and they do use a lot of English script. So keep on progressing is kind of their motto at the UU and NEI, to keep on progressing. So this was the order of service at the anniversary celebration for the Children's Village. I've skipped around a little bit, but basically, I want to go back to being able to ask. I'll go back to the church picture. I want to go back to being able to ask those elders what they believed. And so it was really, really powerful. And I don't mean to overemphasize it, but Sophie from Atlanta said some sort of question that was kind of along the lines of, how do their beliefs differ from those of us in the U.S.? Like, they've encountered a lot of Americans at this point, and a few of our hosts had been to a General Assembly before and visited a couple different congregations in the U.S. And so, you know, what's the big difference between their beliefs and ours? And this is kind of my paraphrasing of what Kluwer said, and he said, we don't ask for Ublé's presence. Ublé is present. Like, we don't need to call for some divine power. It exists all around us, whether we want it there or not. We ask to feel that presence and to connect with that presence. And Ublé is loving. And we wake up and give thanks for being able to take breath for another day and to experience another day. And this experience, this thankfulness, and this love, it is not a burden. In other words, to us, the divine is not a burden. And that's the big difference between, again, I'm re-articulating his words, but I've written in my travel journal in big words, the divine is not a burden. And I think that that is what echoed in my head the most throughout the trip and since coming back from the trip is, what concepts get in our head that make us feel like this is a complicated question, you know? And what if we all just sort of had that openness? So that was important. Okay, so we arrive at the Children's Village for the ceremony, which was absolutely wonderful. And then I'm just going to really kind of quickly try to go through some things. So I had help putting on my gensem, which was a fancy silk dress, in the community house. And we got badges as honored guests. And then I went into the children's home, and Sunita found me. She hugged and hugged me. She showed me around, and I met her uncle, Glenn, who was visiting for the celebration. I was so happy she wanted to connect and didn't seem to want to let go. Her English is excellent, and we had to separate too quickly to attend to some other business. So I was Maureen's photographer, and again, her congregation, Pittsburgh, is sponsoring the school, and this is their first graduates. So she wanted to acknowledge them. It was cold. It was so cold. It was the coldest day in several weeks, and it also rained, and it rained and rained, and it was the rainiest. I mean, it was the only day it rained for several weeks, and so that was a little bit disappointing. And those of us that had purchased fancy dresses the day before were not warm enough and ended up putting on more and more layers as the day went on. And it's raining buckets now. And there are tarps and more tarps going up. There was a stage built with speakers and keyboards and electric guitars and everything else, and more and more tarps and more and more tarps. And men are running into the tree lines, and they're cutting down big stalks of bamboo and then cutting them on the side and peeling it off, and that's the rope. And there's just more and more bamboo, becoming more and more rope, becoming more and more tarps as they try to cover up more and more for the ceremony. And then this is the children doing a song. There was a number of different numbers they did, including traditional dress. There was a rock band from Shillong that came. They were very good, seriously. They were very good. And the headmaster of the school gave a speech, and really his speech was probably my favorite of the day, because he talked about how service to man is service to the greater good. And it was a wonderful, although rainy, experience. To prop the tarps, they took these, you know, like pine trunks and stuck them in boxes of sand to prop them up. and the ceremony's midway through, and that particular one falls, and the muddy stump comes towards me, and so I grab it, and somehow it did not hit anybody in the head, but now water's gushing all over the tarp that's going everywhere, and people are rushing over to take the muddy stump from me and prop it back up, and then a man sat there the rest of the time, and I got to find out where the spigot was to go wash my hands in my fancy dress, which now was pretty muddy, and I think I'd already spilled tea on it by that point. But it was wonderful. It was lovely, and everybody just kept on progressing, kept on going. And then they fed us a very lovely meal in the community house, but it was pretty much just the honored guests. We didn't really get to interact with the kids a lot, which was one of my main goals for being there. But I did meet a woman, an older woman named Mimi, and she told me the folk tale of the betel nut tree, which is the little nut that they chew that makes the lips red. I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about, but the folk tale is I had read about it, but I was really pleased to have somebody tell me it, you know, in their own words. And me and Tehok. And Maureen and Richard and me and Clure were all celebrating. And then this is the student that I sponsored's younger sister, Bali Rishisha, and this is her meeting me for the first time. I should say Bali Rishisha is probably 16 years old. The people here are not very tall in comparison to me. And it was hard to get the kids to figure out how to interact appropriately with kids sometimes because you had no idea how old they were, I guess. It was hard for me. Another just small cultural thing is, so you can see the girls are both wearing little checked aprons there, and so that's a very common thing is, you know, you have to do all your washing by hand and everything else, so that's kind of the apron situation, is that anytime you might be doing any kind of chores or be out and about or find yourself, you know, sitting on something that's not clean, you would tie these little apron, checkered aprons around you. And then their coats are like a big plaid, so the Welsh missionary had left some impact there. And then that night, I actually stayed at Bari's house, and so this is her kitchen fire and her cat. And one of the things I found interesting was that all the kitchen fires, they had these really long logs, and then they just pushed them in as they wanted more wood. So most of the kitchen fires would have 3 or 4 long logs sticking out. I didn't get a good picture of it, but... And so then the next day we went to the kids' school. So this is everybody at the school except for the 12th graders. And this is the school sponsored by Pittsburgh. And then the little girl with the grin in front is Alicia, and she does live at the Children's Village. But these aren't just kids that live at the Children's Village. These are all the kids from the area and all the villages around. And Maureen had brought a quilting project. And so we had all different fabrics, and we took them. And this is the group of kids I kind of got assigned to. Who doesn't sew? How many of our group actually were, you know, seamstresses? And there was about 2. And so they just give us these kids and some stuff. And it was, and they could thread needles better than me and everything else. But they loved the colored fabric and picking out their designs. And so we all did quilt squares. And these kids, again, it was hard because I think that they were probably 10 or 12, and I was thinking they're more like 7 or 8, you know. And so they were hilarious, and the girl with her hands kind of in her lap there together, she really wanted to teach me how to thread a needle better and tie the knot better, and I just had to tell her to give up because she wasn't going to make progress with me that day. But I fully admitted my own deficiencies in that area. I'm not moving forward. There we go. So then the next 2 nights I actually got to stay in the girls' home. And so this is the kitchen in the morning. And I'll try to use my pointer. So there's Sunita standing up, and again, this is kind of the coat situation, the warmth, and this is one of the girls' helpers. She would be called an educator at the home, and this is one of the mothers, Unita. And they have both a propane stove and a cook fire. And then really, this is really kind of their only pantry and storage in the whole kitchen. They have another room that they've used for that as well. And then this is Isha with the house cat, who seemed to really, really like her. And then their cook fire is over here. I'm not sure whose back that is. It might be one of the boys' backs. And then this is a charcoal brazier that we got to warm our toes on. I think that was just for guests. I don't think they do that when there's not guests around. And then for those of you that went to Trunk or Treat last year, you might remember I made little pipe cleaner people to represent the Dread Pirate Roberts and Princess Buttercup from the movie Princess Bride. So I took my pipe cleaner people because they were light, lightweight and easily packable and could not get squished. And they were a big hit. So the days that I got to hang out there, we did pipe cleaner people down the slipper slide and on the swing, and some of them got baths, and they didn't hold up very well after that. But they really discouraged us from taking any gifts that would be considered an extreme luxury, because the Children's Village kids are growing up in the middle of a village. The Children's Village kids having extreme luxury beyond what their village cohorts would have can cause problems. So we were really encouraged to not take items. We met with the village council, and so they're the ones that talked to us just kind of about their struggles with water and power and road maintenance and the forming a cooperative. Like, if they want to get government, any kind of government commodity pricing or any kind of grant from the government, they have to have a cooperative, which has to be legally formed, and they have to have a bank account, and the bank is 45 minutes away, and you know, they have to keep receipts for everything. And so it's just a really difficult situation that they're in, and so we listened as best we could, though none of us really had good advice. This is from the base of the girls' home. The girls' home is up here, and so down a hill, there's a stream where they do have a water pump that pumps water up to the home. But this is all terraced kitchen gardens, and this little shed, it's not so little in this view, but it's not very big, is all vermiculture. And so they're trying to use vermiculture, using worms for compost. So it's a really big vermiculture as far as vermiculture goes. But they have chickens. They are not vegetarian there, and they also eat beef, but just it's so expensive, and there are no beasts of burden. I should make that clear as well. There's no animal husbandry that's happening other than chickens and pigs that I was told about or witnessed, and there are no beasts of burden to help. So the family plots for growing potatoes and growing cabbage can be quite a ways away and can be quite uphill or downhill, and then everything that has to be toted in a basket on your back with the head strap. That is a difficulty. So having the huge kitchen gardens right here by the girls' home is a big benefit, and also the girls can work there and you know that they're safe. The boys' home, by starting to get some government benefits, they had two kind of bedrooms in the girls' home, dormitories, if you will, one for boys, one for girls, and they had to split it to start getting government support because boys and girls cannot live together. So they had to do another fundraising drive to build this building. Design-wise, they felt like they learned some lessons from the girls' home. So this second floor is not finished in any way, shape, or form. It's got chain link all around the outside. But during the rainy season, the boys have a place to go. I'm sure they let the girls come too. But the boys have a place to go that's covered where they can play. And they have some place to hang their laundry, which is a problem for everybody. So I have avoided mentioning a very important person up till now because, again, I can talk and talk and talk. But this is Annie Margaret Barr. And so she was a British Unitarian minister who dedicated her life to the Khasi people. And she lived in the Khasi Hills for over 40 years until her passing in 1973. And if there were Unitarian saints, she would be nominated by the people of Kurong and Mousindri. The local school and the children's village are both named for her, and many elders would introduce themselves to us as one of her students. I was a student of Annie Margaret Barr, and these are the other things about me. And so she had a huge impact on their understanding of health and the importance of education. And she actually was kind of running an orphanage herself out of her home by taking in kids who needed to be taken in during those 40 years. Okay, and so now we're going off script a little bit. I'm going to read from my travel journal. So we went on a field trip, and we got to take some of the kids and some of the mothers and the father from the boys' home, Tenderson, wonderful young man. And so the taxi service in the area is called Sumos. I don't know. Anyway, so you rent a Sumo. You can rent a Sumo and tell them to show up at such and such a time to pick up so many people. Or there's ones that just kind of travel around and you can hop in. Well, the travel around and hop in ones, like, people really hop in. Like, they're, you know, there's a lot of people in a small vehicle or on the top or on the back, and almost all of them will have some sort of, rack where people can stand and hold things and pack baskets or other things like that. And so we rented two Jeep-type Sumos to come and take us to a scenic overlook and then down to the river. We were going to get to see rice paddies, and it was a beautiful day, not raining and everything else. And so we got to experience the roads again. And these are, like, narrow, very curvy, again, mountainous, some places only one lane, you know, and you go around. And strangely, there would be buses a little bit lower down in the mountain, so you go around a curve on a one lane, and then there's this huge bus coming at you. In any case, so we rented two Sumos. And they're so big. Everybody at the Children's Village was so excited because they could take so many people. And so the outside of the Sumos ended up being stacked up with boys from the boys' home. So they're riding on the back and they're riding on the top. And they just completely could not understand why Daniel would not allow Gio, father and son, why Daniel would not allow Gio to ride on the outside with them. Because they really liked Gio, and this was going to be a super fun adventure together. And Daniel's like, no, no, no. And Gio's like, my dad won't let me. So that was an interesting cultural moment. And so here we are going, and this is when we were all having fun. This is when we were all having fun. So, again, we're going to the scenic outlook. There's no signs. You know, it's not like you're going out here by the Flint Hills and it says scenic overlook and there's a turning lane and a place to park. And our driver clearly did not have any idea where he's going. And we lost the other Sumo, you know, like 30 minutes ago. And he stops and asks for directions three times. And we all have faith, you know, we're in the right general area and we'll find it or whatever. But then we go down this road and it's like really steep down and there's not nothing. I mean, it's just, there's a precipice, and he just keeps inching and inching. And so then one of our boys jumps off the back of the Sumo and goes and stands and is looking over the top and looking back at the Sumo, and our guy is still inching and inching and inching forward. And so at some point, I'm going to point fingers, at some point, I believe Valerie and Karen both screamed at the exact same time, "Stop now!" And at that point, we were not having a lot of fun. And this is what I drew in my travel journal about that. And so here's our young man staring over the precipice and our boys on the top of the Jeep and us inching more and more forward for posterity. It all turned out okay. It all turned out okay. But by the time we got to the scenic overlook, a lot of us adults in the car were pretty much like, okay, yeah, we're over this. Let's move on. But the kids enjoyed it. So then we went down to the river, which is evidently doesn't really have a name. There's river systems there, but each of these individual rivers, they don't really name again. I couldn't figure it out, at least. Can't find it on a map. And we crossed this suspension bridge, and Sunita did not want to go across. This is Sunita getting yelled at by her friend, Wishkam Lang, get over here. And finally, the helper for the girls' home just, like, came up behind her and told her she had to go. And so this is what the bridge looked like. And these are rice paddies all along here. Again, it's the dry season. And these are some boats we found. And so the kids go around the bend. We had to cross back over the river by some rocks, and only Katie and I got wet. And the adults went up and got back in the Sumos and then drove back down to the river, and the kids just walk around the bend. And as we're getting there, as we're going to the bend, as we're trying to reconnect with the kids. Yes, we left a couple adults with them. But as we're trying to reconnect with the kids, the Sumos have to cross two areas of water that was almost high enough to get in the Jeeps. And then we get stuck. One of them gets stuck, like terribly stuck, like badly stuck. But we can see the children off in the distance. And so we all got out and went and collected all the children. And they were having a blast skipping rocks. And we're going back, and here's our stuck sumo. And people are bouncing on it and throwing rocks under the wheels and everything else. And it was, again, quite an adventure. A lot of mud was getting on shoes. We were joking who had brought snacks, who had brought coats, who was going to have to spend the night there, who got to ride the one available sumo back to the village, and who had to spend the night. And as we're, and so anyway, they eventually get it unstuck. And then both of the sumos just take off and leave us there. And maybe they talked to somebody and we didn't hear it, you know, who knows. But there was a lot of confusion. And they had driven across the two water crossings that they had driven us over before just to try to avoid possibly getting stuck again. They had driven, you know, they had driven and driven to the best possible place that they could for us to get back in. So we get back in. And as we're walking across all of those places, Sunita tells me that the area is full of leeches. Now, I got clarification that that is in the rainy season. That's not right now. But still, we were gone for hours and hours longer than we anticipated. I don't have any more pictures of that for right now. But by now, it's dark. We're driving home in the dark, windy, windy roads and one-way roads. And again, the first sumo just takes off and leaves us. Oh, we stop. We stop to pick up some guys and some baskets of produce. And we're like, in our minds, we're like stuffed. You know, the sumo is as full as it could or should be. But no, we stop and pick up like three grown men and a bunch of baskets of produce. And we have to beg one of our boys just to even get in the car, just get in the car, you know. And so he finally did. And he was freezing. I mean, his hands were cold and everything else. And so at one point on that way home, one of our boys also fell off a sumo at a time we were going relatively slow. And he said he was fine, and there was never anything else that happened. But it was just a cultural immersion experience that I will not forget, and it was awesome. And the best part for me really was when we got back home to the girls' house, the girls each ate three plates of food. I mean, they were just starving, and so that everybody had gone with us was just eating and eating and eating. And just when they finish, essentially they're eating the leftovers from whatever meal was made earlier in the day. And just when they basically finish all the food, the boys come slinking in, hoping that there's leftovers there because they're hungry. But it was all gone, and they said that the food was better at the girls' home. So they try to eat there as often as possible. So anyway, it was wonderful, and everybody really enjoyed it. But there was some mud, and there were a few. Oh, I'm sorry. And Maureen's from the University of Pittsburgh, and at one point she screamed, "We are breaking 15 rules for university-led trips. I am not in charge." And we're like, everybody just heard, "Maureen's in charge. Maureen's in charge." And she didn't like that joke. She didn't like that joke. But it was wonderful. And it's not very common for the kids to get to do field trips, so that was a really big thing for them. So this is the church in Mausendri, and these are the dogs, two of the village dogs. The village dogs all went to church. The doors were open during the service, and the dogs came in and out, and each little house had kind of a dog that was most local to it, and some of the dogs liked each other and some of them didn't, so you kind of got to know the dog personalities. And this is somebody ringing the bell to tell everybody that service is about to start. And their practice there is that they have children's church first, which typically I'm not sure that adults would be there, almost any adults would be there at all. So this is Sunita, the student that I sponsor, and Bari Shisha, and I cannot remember this Minsong daughter's name, but her last name is Minsong. But the kids, the oldest kids, run a church service. They get up, Sunita's the convener, they light a chalice, they have a speaker, they say a few things, they say a few hymns, they're in their casual clothes, and then they go home. And they change clothes and they go back to regular church. And so that is a big part of their tradition that Daniel was really, like, hyped up about. He said, so they're not teaching kids the whys or anything of church. They're teaching them how to church. This is how you do it. You get people together. You put together a program. You do what's meaningful for you. So he loved that. So this is after just children's church. And again, there's a lot of adults there because we're visiting, but I don't think that would be very common. And then, again, we went home and people got more dressed up. And so these are the junior becoming senior students who are getting ready to start school. And they put on their daras and they sang us a beautiful song. And so then we're sort of winding down our time together. And so just a few things here so that I don't get emotional. Sunita is left-handed. Her favorite color is red. She has seen the Harry Potter movies. I did make one big mistake, cultural interfacing mistake while I was there. I took the calendar that Sandy made of everything here. I took some K-State swag to give to various people that I met. I took some sunflower scarves, and I took some sunflower seeds because I thought, well, you know, take something from your home where the sunflower state. So I took sunflower seeds, and I specifically thought the kids would have fun having a spitting contest with the sunflower seeds because that's something we do in Nickerson, Kansas, and that's a tradition that I can teach you. And I thought kids around the world spit things for distance and that that was a universal thing. Not so much. So number one, they thought I was really weird for spitting good food. Number two, they just have never spit things for distance before. But I'm committed to this because I know it can be fun. And so this is me doing one example spit. This was a terrible mistake. This was a terrible mistake because my example spit went 5 feet farther than any spit that came after me. So they think I'm a ringer. They think, you know, that I'm just showing off at this point. They're asking me, how do you spit? I'm like, you spit. You put it your tongue and then you spit. And it did not go over particularly well. I think they forgave me. And the mothers are like yelling because now they're just eating sunflower seeds and they're spitting the shells everywhere and they don't want the shells all over the yard. So that one did not, I may have made some mistakes. Unita is one of the mothers of the girls' home, and I weaseled my way into her good graces, and she was really, really very sweet and a wonderful hostess to me. This is some of the food that we were prepared, mainly by Unita and Reloom. The last night I was there, I stayed at the Minsong house. I believe Mrs. Minsong has 11 daughters. This would be her oldest, and this would be her youngest. The oldest is called Kong, so in my family, I would be Kong Molly. And the youngest is called Dodo, and so my sister would be Dodo Hannah, and the youngest sister, would be the one who's going to kind of take over for the family. Many of the daughters live close. Son is a taxi driver, but they were going over their family photo albums with me, which was really fun. And then here we are the next morning, and this is Mrs. Minsong in the sunflower scarf, which she really liked, and her grandkids that live with her. And this is Reloom, and as I said, there's a height difference. This is Reloom, and she's one of the other mothers at the girls' home. Very, very sweet. And this is our group of all the Americans that went on the pilgrimage, except for Karen, who's still at Kerrang Village, and then all the kids and their helpers, boys' home, girls' home. You'll notice there's some Lone Star stuff happening here. That was a gift from the Dallas congregation as they brought their own levels of swag. The quilt that we had started got completed on this sewing machine, belt on it is denim sewed in many layers and pedal push. And so Maureen and the owner of the sewing machine were able to get it pieced together. I pause again. Oh, shoot. I'm taking too long. Sorry, guys. I pause again for a couple things to read from my travel journal because we're on our goodbyes here. So as we're doing our goodbyes, they start going around and asking everybody to say something. And I'm with two ministers and somebody that's been there 4 times, you know. And I really don't want them to look at me. I really don't. But they do. And so I had to say something to the whole group. And so this is my memory of what I said when I wrote it in my journal. I said I was impressed that it was clear they were raising great kids. That raising great kids takes good adults, like the mothers and fathers of the girls' home and the boys' home, a good school, a good church, and good supportive community, and that they all clearly had that. I said that I had been blessed the day before to share the family blessing that we've said at my house for years before meals, which is short. It says, let us be grateful for the food on our table. Let us keep friends and family in our thoughts, and let us be aware of our consequence. And the most important word there is consequence. And that when I talk about consequence, particularly to kids, it's about choices and the choices that we're making every day impacting others. And that it's clear that in raising the great kids that they're raising, everyone was making great choices. And I got some applause on that, so I guess I did an okay job representing this congregation. And part of this whole process, this pilgrimage process, was to, we had all these calls beforehand, and then at any time we could, we would be called together as a group to reflect on what was happening. Like, they wanted us to process as it was happening. And that was really hard for me, because I knew what I was feeling about it, but I didn't know what I was thinking. And even now today, all these months later, I say, I know how I feel about it, but I still don't know what I think about it. It's hard to put it into words. But one of the challenges that we were given shortly after leaving the village was, what's your elevator speech? What are you going to say somebody about this partnership or this village? And some of my fellow travelers were saying, well, I don't want to make it a caricature. I don't want to oversimplify it. I don't want to do any of those things. And we all agreed. But I shared that I thought it was pretty important that we emphasize that the only reason that we had the warm welcome and the access that we had to experience this village life for the brief time that we did was because we're standing on the shoulders of giants. We're standing on 100 years of collaboration and partnership. And so we didn't have to do anything to earn trust. We just walk in, and we're staying in their homes. And we just walk in, and the kids want to tell us about their lives. And that is, it was so welcoming and wonderful and powerful that the years and years and years of partnership that very few of us on that trip, two of the 10 of us, had put in some of that time, but that for a long, long time there's been successful collaborative partnership with this area of the world and our faith relatives. And so it was a very impressive area, but that my speech is it's long-standing partnership that allowed that to happen. And then I will close. I'm grateful for these belief relatives. I'm grateful for their willingness to be open to our bodies and our questions. There is so much good in the world. And I can embrace it. I easily embrace the good in this world. And embracing it is not a burden. And perhaps that is divine. Perhaps the construct of the divine I have had in my head is wrong. Can I take the leap and say the divine is not a burden to me? I'm willing to try. So we are at 5 minutes until 12, and I did intend to have time for questions, but we can finish up with our hymn, and then I can take questions afterwards if people have more questions, okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Molly. Yes, one more.
I have a whole bunch of slides. Yeah, I just have a whole bunch of slides you want to skip past.
I'm skipping past slides. That was only if we ran really short on time, which we did not. We did not.
Thank you so much. Great story. We look forward to us talking more about it. Now, stand in body and spirit, if you can. And we'll sing this last hymn, and which in the book is Answering the Call of Love. It's Standing on the Side of Love, and we're going to be singing the words in the refrain, Answering the Call of Love. So, get away, Dustin. We'll see how that goes.
Thank you.
And now in the words of Burton Carley, we are cheered by our community, blessed by our mission, uplifted in mind and renewed in spirit. Go forth with courage and in peace and meet the days to come. So may it be, and join us in coffee.